Today we're going to be wrapping up our study in the book of Numbers. As I promised, it's gone by much faster than previous books did. We took about a year on Genesis, about a year on Exodus, about 6 months on Leviticus, and now only about 3 months on Numbers. That, of course, was primarily because so much of Numbers was relevant to topics discussed previously, and for that reason we had referenced a large percentage of the book of Numbers before we ever even started reading it. Numbers is also much heavier with narrative than with legal minutiae, and recounting narratives tends to move more quickly than digging into the myriad ethical ramifications of laws. However, the short amount of time which was spent on Numbers specifically shouldn't be taken to mean that the book is any less important, or that we haven't given it its due attention. All scripture is God-breathed and profitable for teaching. And just as with any book, we've considered Numbers verse by verse with the intent of leaving absolutely nothing behind. That is not to say, though, that we have yet touched on everything. After today's message, we'll still have some 10% of the book which we have not thoroughly discussed. But the topics we'll be passing by are ones which will fit nicely with topics to be discussed as we work through Deuteronomy. Never fear, it is my plan to wrap up Deuteronomy with not a single verse in the Torah remaining unpreached. And currently, I project that we'll do that by November of 2019. So with that housekeeping aside, let's move on to today's passage. If you've been listening along to these messages chronologically as I record them, then you know that 5 weeks ago we discussed Israel's battles in the Transjordan, or East Jordan, area. At that time, they conquered a large swath of land. This week we consider Numbers chapter 32, in which they decide what to do with it. And that, incidentally, will be to give it as an inheritance to the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. If you have not yet read Numbers 32, I recommend that you pause and do so now. First, a little context. God brought Israel up out of Egypt with the promise that he would give them the land of Canaan. In general, that describes the land occupied by the Canaanites living west of the Jordan River, though there were also Canaanites, a sub-branch known as Amorites, living east of the Jordan River. Relatively early in their travels, Israel had an opportunity to attack the land of Canaan west of the Jordan by traveling counterclockwise around the south side of the Dead Sea and attacking to the south. This southern border, we note, was heavily fortified because of the threat of invasion by Egypt. I cite from my source for this G. Ernest Wright's Biblical Archaeology, which we have mentioned before and for which you will find a link in the library. Israel refused to attack at that time, despite God's instructions that they should do so, and as a result, God punished them with 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. Now, 40 years have passed, and Israel is preparing to make a new attack, this time by crossing the Jordan River. The Jordan would have been less fortified for several reasons. First, the Jordan itself acted as a natural protective barrier. Second, the area directly west of the Jordan was mountainous, meaning that it was likely less densely populated and also more difficult to navigate. And finally, the occupants of the Transjordan were Canaanites, so they likely had peaceful relations with the people in the area west of the Jordan. For that reason, they didn't feel a need to build up the same kind of fortifications. I will note that the archaeological discovery of ancient fortifications in the south of Canaan, dated to before Israel's conquest of that land, are an excellent demonstration of the truth of the scriptures. We know that the Israelites were not the original inhabitants of the land. We know that they came up out of slavery in Egypt. Well, how did a bunch of slaves manage to leave Egypt and conquer a country which had a border so heavily fortified that they could fend off Egypt, which at that time was the original world superpower? Well, the answer to that is exactly what we've been reading in Scripture, that Israel crossed the sea and then wandered the wilderness, and instead of initiating their conquest by attacking through the Negev or southland of Canaan, they took a winding route around the other nations and crossed the Jordan River. The Bible's solution is the most plausible solution available, given the archaeological evidence. Some may suggest that the Bible is a book of fables or that the miraculous things recorded here are impossible. Well, those people are going to have a much harder time explaining how Israel went from slavery in Egypt to conquest of Canaan than I am. But of course, the tension in today's passage comes in that at least some of the people don't really need the promised land west of the Jordan for anything, because they've already got a perfectly good chunk of land right here. The passage opens by telling us that the people of the tribes of Reuben and Gad had a large number of livestock. And my supposition is that this was an exceptionally large number of animals when compared to the other tribes. and this large number of animals created a problem. It would be difficult to herd all of those animals into a war zone on the other side of the Jordan River. To the contrary, there was plenty of good land for grazing right there where they were. And for that reason, the people of these two tribes started asking, why should we go over the Jordan when we can just settle here? And in verses 2 through 5, they ask Moses for permission to do just that. In verses 6 through 15, we read that Moses was not at all inclined initially to support the idea. In fact, when I read this story, I envision Moses flying into a rage. This request brings back nothing but bad memories for Moses. 40 years ago, he and the people of Israel were doomed to wander the wilderness for 40 years because the people refused to go up and fight the Canaanites. Moses, now 120 years old, has been waiting his entire life for this. Not only that, but he's seen how just a few people rebelling can bring down the entire organization. Remember, it was only 10 spies refusing to invade the Promised Land who convinced all Israel to stay in the wilderness. Now Moses sees two whole tribes who are preparing to weaken the resolve of everyone. And if that happens, Moses speculates, then God will send the people back into the wilderness again, and this time he will completely destroy them. Recall that only Moses' intercession on behalf of Israel rescued them the first time. It might be too much to expect that again. And not only that, but the ungratefulness of it all. Moses wants nothing more than to enter the Promised Land, but he won't be allowed to. How could these young people who have an opportunity to have what he can never have turn it down? And furthermore, Moses sees selfishness and cowardice in this request. There's a piece of land that has been conquered, and which was conquered by all the tribes, but now these two tribes presume that they ought to be able to take it for themselves? And then after all Israel helped them get this nice piece of land, would they presume to sit back and enjoy its fruits while everyone else has to go off and fight for their own chunk of ground on the other side of the Jordan? For making this request, Moses calls them a brood of sinful men. Well, maybe they were sinful men, but either Moses' reply convinced them, or Moses jumped too quickly to a conclusion. In verse 16, the men representing the tribes of Reuben and Gad are quick to either clarify their position or to make a counteroffer. They weren't refusing to enter Canaan along with everyone else. They were just asking to live in the good land that they had already available to them. They were hoping that they could leave all their livestock and their children in safety, greatly increasing the efficiency as warriors, and they were hoping to come back to this same land when the war was over, but they weren't asking to avoid the war or the conquest altogether. In fact, they told Moses that if he would do that, then they would both stay in the Promised Land until the war was concluded and be the first ones to cross the Jordan and lead the march into dangerous territory. So they were serious about the offer. They weren't backing out of anything. They weren't going to wait for the army to march ahead and then turn tail and run once no one was looking. They were fully committed to the cause, and they would be held accountable to both initiate it and see it to completion. And that was a deal Moses could agree with. If they would do that, then good. They could have this land. If not, then they would be in their sin, and their sin would not be forgotten. So with that, Moses blessed them with his permission to build cities and sheepfolds as places to keep their livestock and their families. Of note, these were probably not the world's finest cities. They had less than a year to build them. My supposition is that they repurposed the ruins of the towns that they had conquered into hospitable shelters, said, "It's better than just living in tents," and then went off to war. And in fact, Joshua 22 mentions that they still had tents when they went back across the Jordan. In verses 24 through 27, the Gadites and the Reubenites repeated their commitment. Moses, however, displayed some distrust and made the deal public. Moses knew that he would die soon, and that he wouldn't personally be around during the invasion. For that reason, he summoned the next generation of leadership, Eleazar, the new high priest, Joshua, his right-hand man and successor, and then all the tribal heads of Israel. Once they were gathered, Moses reiterated the deal for them. If Reuben and Gad will go first across the Jordan and then fight until the war is over, then they can keep this land. But if they don't, then they'll have to take land on the other side of the Jordan, just like everyone else. And of course, they would be much more motivated to fight if they could only keep what they won in battle. In verse 32, the Gadites and Reubenites publicly agree. And so with the deal formally ratified, Moses gives the land to the two tribes. A portion of the land is also given to some of the tribe of Manasseh. and the inclusion of the tribe of Manasseh is a bit of a mystery here. The tribe of Manasseh splits in half. One half will make a home in the east, and the other half in the west. We have no indication, however, of why they chose to split, or along what lines. The tribe of Manasseh was not the largest, so they didn't split just because of numbers. It's also not clear exactly when they got in on this deal, or how. Originally, the land was being divided up because of livestock enumeration, so perhaps some of the Manassehites had large numbers of livestock and didn't want to move on, while others wanted to live on the other side of the Jordan. However, we get the idea that Manasseh ended up with land east of the Jordan because of exceptional military drive. Verses 39 through 42 describe three descendants of Manasseh who led military campaigns, evidently apart from the other tribes, to win land north of the other tribes. These men were Machir, Jair, and Noba. The passage tells that they each conquered Amorite territory north of the land held by Gad, and as a result, Moses granted them the lands they conquered. So to take the best evidence that the passage gives us, it appears that Manasseh split because some of its people performed the exceptional military exploit of taking the land on their own, and as such, they had a right to it. We would suppose that the tribe split such that those who had done the fighting east of the Jordan got the land they won, and the rest of Manasseh who had not fought got whatever they would earn on the other side. But there is some speculation there. In any case, two and a half tribes inherited land east of the Jordan. Those were Gad, Reuben, and the half-tribe which I will henceforth refer to as East Manasseh. And the remainder of the verses, which we have not yet discussed, describe how the two tribes of Reuben and Gad restored the cities which had been previously conquered, renaming them, and how they built places for keeping their livestock. Of note, Moses will reference this event again in Deuteronomy 3:12-22. There he gave a recounting of the major events in the wilderness, including the land grant to the Transjordan tribes. And his account there matches that which we read here. He mentions that the land was taken from Sihon and Og and was given to the two and a half tribes. He notes that this was once a land occupied by giants and that the Israelites renamed their new territory. He also mentions Jair and Machir, two of our Manassite conquerors, specifically, and accurately lists the location and their borders in a way which is consistent both with the description in Numbers and with modern maps. As I have noted before, the Bible displays a remarkable degree of consistency, especially when compared to other works of antiquity, other religious works, and other historical accounts. This is a compelling evidence that the Bible was written at both a time and place close to the events described in it, and that its authors were guided by divine influence. And of course, Moses also reiterates the commitment made by the Transjordanian tribes in exchange for the land, that the men could leave their women, children, and their plentiful livestock behind, but could not return to them until the conquest of the promised land was complete. And I am pleased to report to you that Reuben, Gad, and East Manasseh all kept their word. The tribes kept their word by crossing the Jordan. In Joshua chapter 1 at verse 12, we read of how Joshua reminded the Reubenites, Gadites, and East Manassehites of their commitment, specifically that their fighting men must enter the promised land ahead of their brothers, and that they could come home to their own land across the Jordan after the conquest was complete. The men of the two and a half tribes responded by saying that they would not only obey Joshua in this regard, but in everything, just as they had obeyed Moses. And furthermore, they promised to put to death any of their members who refused to obey. And they did indeed stick around for the conquest. Now, Israel didn't ever completely conquer every inch of ground that they were supposed to take in Joshua's lifetime, but they did take most of it to such a degree that Joshua was satisfied. And in Joshua chapter 22, Joshua declared that the Transjordan tribes had fulfilled their obligation, and he sent them back across the Jordan, with a reminder that they must still abide by God's word when they arrived there. And of course, when the lines of inheritance were recounted, as happens in both Joshua and Deuteronomy, we find that these tribes were given the portions which had been allotted to them in today's passage. I think that we should note that while all of this sounds cheery so far, there was at least some difficulty with having tribes on both sides of the river. A river can be a formidable physical barrier. We don't think about that much today because our grandparents devoted so much energy to building bridges, and cars that could drive across bridges, and airplanes that could fly over rivers altogether. But in a time when the primary method of transportation was on the back of a donkey, crossing a river like the Jordan was a difficult and dangerous prospect. So having the river in the middle meant that the two and a half tribes would have some communication strain between themselves and the western tribes. We have a story in the last half of Joshua chapter 22 regarding an incident of miscommunication between the tribes, which would be almost comical if it weren't for the fact that it almost ended in war between the two sides of the river. But that, as you might expect, will be another story for another day. So then, that's Numbers 32. In this chapter, we saw the beginning of a theme which will continue to echo throughout, at least, the book of Joshua, and which will have ramifications for Israel throughout the Old Testament, that the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh chose to settle in the land which Israel had conquered on the east side of the Jordan River. They did this because the land was good, and because they had plenty of livestock which needed a place to stay. In exchange for the grant of that land, Moses insisted that these tribes be the first to cross the Jordan, and that they remain in the battle west of the Jordan until the conquest was complete. And they did so. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.